Hey, fellow writers. This week, we've got an outright amazing conversation with Susan Wiggs, many, many times best-selling author of many, many novels, who really knows how to construct a story. And when getting the work done doesn't just take talent and dedication, but an understanding of the craft of creating a story. If you'd like to work with someone who understands that craft, head over to Author Accelerator and look into finding the right book coach for your work. Or, if craft is your jam, learn more about becoming a book coach yourself at authoraccelerator.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause, and
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now, one, two, three.
Okay.
I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag MWriting. Hashtag MWriting is the podcast, the weekly podcast about writing all things. Fiction, nonfiction, short things, long things, pitches, proposals, everything you have to write before anybody lets you write anything. And in short, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting that work done.
And this is Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels. You can always find more about me at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, and also of the book How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor of the New York Times' Mother Love blog, and still sometimes a contributor there. And we are so excited to welcome our guest this week. This is the first guest we've ever had that has rivaled Serena in prolificness. We are so excited to welcome Susan Wiggs. She is the author of, I think I counted 37, but as soon as I let her talk, I'm going to check, novels, a multiple number one New York Times bestseller, and an overall amazing storyteller. When you pick up a Susan Wiggs book, you know that you're getting a fully built world and a story that's going to grab you and hold you tight, and that you're going to be sorry when it lets you go. Her current novel is The Lost and Found Bookstore. And she's also got another novel just out in paperback, The Oysterville Sewing Circle. That one's just out right now. Am I right?
That's correct. It's just out in a paperback edition for the book club edition. Just came out.
Ooh, cool. I love the whole book club edition and this edition and that edition.
It's really great. I just love book clubs in general. So, yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is such a thrill to talk to somebody who's not a fictional character.
Yeah, we don't do much of that right now either. They're either fictional characters or they live in our house. That's all we got. So yeah, we are really excited to tell how many books is it before I even get started?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. And you know what? To be honest,
Serena can never do it either.
I know. I don't have a count, but I can tell you my first book was published in 1987.
Wow.
By Kensington Zebra Books. And I've published a book or two every year since. And so I've stopped doing the math. I'm done. I just write my
next
book.
We won't ask you to do any math, but we will ask you, just because our listeners always want to know, how'd you get started? Tell us how that first 1987 book happened. Travel back in time with us.
Oh, that, you know what? It's always, you always remember your first time. And I'll just leave it at that. I'll leave that to your imagination. But honestly, I was a young teacher, just out of graduate school. I got myself through graduate school by reading really big, thick, heaving bosom romance novels. You know, the real awesome bodice rippers all through the 80s. And so, I had such a taste for them and such a affection for them and a love for the form that I just wrote one. And I had no idea what I was doing. I wrote it on a typewriter. I didn't know about any writers' associations. I didn't know about, I knew Writer's Digest. I was a subscriber to Writer's Digest. I always knew that I wanted to write. And so I wrote a book called Texas Wildflower. And I wrote it on a typewriter. It was this huge, unwieldy pile of pages. I was very proud of it, but I didn't know what to do with it. And so somehow I wormed my way onto an editor's desk at Kensington Books, which had and probably still has imprints, Zebra, Pinnacle, various ones like that. And they're still up and going. And the editor's name was Wendy McCurdy, and she's still in the business. I believe she's still back. She may be back at Kensington now. Anyway, she was a delightful, you know, very young, probably as young as I was at the time, editor who called me up in the middle of a very busy life. I had a toddler and dogs and a house and a teaching job, and I was very overwhelmed. And she called me in the middle of all that and said, "We like your book and we want to publish it." And I was, wow. I was just floored. Yes, I was stunned. I didn't have an agent. And so I just said, yes, where do I sign? And so it's interesting that we would be talking about this right now, because one of the things that I did, because I didn't have a literary agent, I didn't really know how to negotiate any sort of contract. And one of the biggest blunders that I made that is turning out to be kind of a very funny and happy accident was I gave them the copyright back then, and I think now copyrights revert to the author if the book is out of print and unavailable for, I believe, 3 to 5 years. And I think I signed my name to something to say it was out of print and unavailable, but they had 16 years to reprint it.
Oh, wow.
So I basically gave them, yeah, and in those 16 years, my books became rather popular, and so they never wanted to revert the rights to me, because I would always, I would say, the book's not out, it's very old, don't you want to revert the rights to me? Because that way, the author gets control of the rights and creative control over that property, and you know, you can resell it and things like that. But no, they kept hanging on to it. And so I'm sitting here, I'm here it is, what, 2020, and I'm looking at a royalty check dated May 26, 2020 for that book, for Texas Wildflower, that was first published in April 1987.
Wow.
Because they keep reprinting it.
So they do still have it in print.
They still have it in print. They've reissued it numerous times in different packaging. And as my books have evolved, you know, it was definitely the very original cover. You can probably find it on my website, susanwiggs.com, was a very, very in-your-face bodice ripper cover. I just loved it. I thought it was really cool. But as my books have become more mainstream and evolved into general fiction or mainstream fiction, the covers look very upmarket now and rather sophisticated. And it's basically the same book. At one point, I did go in and do some light editorial work, and, you know, cringing the whole time, because obviously after, you know, 50 something books, I'm not that same writer that wrote Texas Wildflower. And so I had some rookie moments in that book, many of them. And yet readers still, they're drawn to something about that book. So, it's still in print. So thank you, Kensington Books, for keeping me alive on your list.
That's a great story, and I love that it is still out there. And the cover thing is really funny, because we have talked to a lot of authors, and we've seen that same evolution many times. And I know Serena and I are both really fascinated by cover art and why publishers and authors pick one style over the other, and the new trend towards the sort of drawings instead of actual pictures of people.
All authors are obsessed with cover art. You know, even before I was published, I was designing the cover in my head, and I'm terrible at it. But I'm always gratified when I see the way that my books go out into the market, because usually it's spot on. There have been some turkeys in my in my repertoire, you know, no fault of mine or the publisher. Sometimes they just don't turn out well. But the new mm-hmm. book, the Lost and Found Bookshop, did you guys get a copy of it, or the advanced reading copy?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I am about, I really love it. But do you know what? My copy doesn't have a cover.
It doesn't. Oh my gosh.
So I haven't seen it.
Oh my gosh.
No.
It's beautiful though. I love the cover.
Well, the journey, that cover went through so many iterations. And the reason is that they try to build, and this is a really great thing about publishers, if they're committed to an author, they really try to build you as a brand. And so you don't want each cover to be so unique that it doesn't even look like it could be by the same author. And so I had a rather good hit with the Oysterville Sewing Circle last year. And one of the big pieces and one reason that that book really struck a chord was it had an incredibly striking cover. It was like stark white with this blood red spool of thread on the front with a sharp pin sticking through it. And they wanted to build on that, but I wrote about a bookshop, so there's no sharp needles or anything. And so we really struggled with what it should look like, this new book should look like, so that it kind of accesses the spirit of the previous book, but also is inviting and beautiful enough to attract new readers as well. So I hope this cover does it. It hasn't hit the shelves yet, so I guess we'll see.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. And I can see how it looks with the Oysterville Sewing Circle. I've just pulled it up.
Right. It's a lovely analogy to that other book. But I also noticed that Oysterville has a new cover, too, which is also very beautiful. And sometimes publishers do that if they don't like a cover. But sometimes they do it just to catch the eye of people who didn't grab it the first time.
Yeah, well, there's been three iterations of the Oysterville cover. The first one with the big spool of thread was the hardcover. And then there was a mass market paperback that came out in January. And it's because of the time we're in, the pandemic time, it was widely available only in essential markets like Walmart, the places that could stay open during the pandemic. And so it's sold like wildfire in March. It was the number 4 New York Times paperback in March. And so there was this little paperback edition of it. And then they decided for this summer to do a premium paperback. They're called trade size paperback. And it's a bigger edition and they add extra content in the back. I think there's a reading group guide and an article and a recipe and some other materials back there. To give reading groups something to chew on. And then they decided, well, let's use a new image on this cover. And the one that they did on that edition, it was actually a rejected hardcover look. You know, they tried several looks in it and they knew it was a pretty look, but they wanted to go out in trade paperback with that one. So no effort is ever wasted. That's what I am finding out.
Apparently.
Yeah. My agent calls it four bites at the apple, because the fourth bite is the audiobook. And audiobooks are quite a big category these days. And there was a slump during pandemic, but as things are opening and people are going back to work and commuting again, there's an upturn in audio sales.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I definitely felt that audio slump in April.
So you have so many books under your belt, and you were talking about how that first one is very, very different from the writer that you are now. And I wanted to talk about how you go about now structuring a new story, because your stories are so... I've only read your later stuff, so I didn't read that early,
yeah,
so I
please
can't
don't.
Compare them, but your stories, but your stories now are so, so tight, and they really don't have a lot of extraneous stuff, and I really would love to hear where you start from, and I guess start with that. Where do you start when you're looking to start a new book?
That's one of those things that probably didn't change a lot from the very beginning. What inspires us? You know, something has to grab you, and it's almost visceral. And for example, in the Lost and Found Bookshop, it was very, it was a very stark moment that I had. I was speaking with some elderly people that lived at my mother's assisted living place, and I'm in charge of my mom's elder care. She now lives with me. And so I do a lot of speaking with groups like that. And one question that I love to ask older people is, what if you had a do-over? You know, what if you got to make a different decision in your life? And so somebody said something like, I would have been a meteorologist, but women weren't allowed to do that back then. And I thought, wow, you know, I want to write about somebody who does get that opportunity. You know, she does get to walk away from her very steady, predictable corporate job and life. Unfortunately, what drives her to that point is very tragic, but she does get there. And suddenly she gets to make a new blueprint for her life. And so I was very inspired by that. And I realized that with every book, even from that very, very first one, it's a moment of profound change in a character's life, whether it's a decision that she has to make or some situation that's forced on her. And so I'm always fascinated by that. And it's always, you know, my characters are, there's a lot of variety. They come from all walks of life, but she's usually the smartest person in the book, but she doesn't know it. That's the one thing I would say they have in common. But from there, the process has become not a routine for me, but definitely a journey that has familiar signposts. You know, I have to know my character, and I get to know her in ways that come to me subconsciously, or, you know, I consciously research her world. I build her world around her. What does she do? What does she fear? What was her family of origin like? That's huge for me, because I believe that people as adults are the sum of their family of origin, good, bad, indifferent, or, you know, a mixture, usually a mixture of everything. And I sort of build the character psychologically and physically that way. And at that point, I kind of have a sketch. It's usually written down in sketchy notes, and then I figure out what does she want? You know, what is her utmost desire? And I try to figure out what that is, and then find ways for her to not be able to have that. Because that's where the, I know, it's kind of mean, but that's where the story comes from.
Oh, we do it too.
Yeah, because people read for the struggle. I do. You know, somebody wants something, you know, Dorothy wants to get back to Kansas, or Luke Skywalker wants to, you know, destroy the Death Star or whatever. So the main character has to want something that is profoundly important to them, whether it's, you know, to revive a failing bookstore and look after her elderly granddad, or to create a women's support group for domestic violence survivors, which is the Oysterville Sewing Circle. There has to be a really powerful want that I believe I relate to and readers might relate to. And once I have that, I'm off to the races. I sort of pick the setting, and I populate her world, and I create a plot, and I write an outline. And I say outline, it's really just a 5 to 10 page present tense narrative that I then pitch to my literary agent and my editor, sometimes separately, sometimes simultaneously. And they usually have things, you know, some feedback for me, as does my writing group. I have a writing group that I meet with regularly here on the West Coast, up in Puget Sound is where I'm broadcasting from. And through that process, I get a roadmap for my book. And then I kind of disappear with my pen and paper for about 6 months. And I do write with pen and paper. It's kind of old school, but it keeps the distractions at bay while I'm drafting the story.
Wow. I want to come back to drafting with pen and paper, but Serena and I often talk about, I'm only on like novel number 2 in terms of anything I'm going to try to sell, but
then you are light years ahead of 99% of everybody else, believe me.
And I don't discount my achievement. I'm super excited. My debut is coming out this summer. Everything is going great. And I'm just literally like painful minutes away from giving the draft of the second book to my agent so we can figure out if maybe we can go out with it before the first one comes out. That's the boring details.
I love it. You know, every writer is convinced that all the other writers have the answer. And we always want to pick each other's brain.
Well, yes, it's easier for everyone else.
I want to hear how everybody else does it, because I'm doing something wrong because I am so stuck right now.
Well, we often talk about whether you start from the emotional story or the plot story. And it sounds like for you, it's almost always the emotional story.
Yes, because I have to have some sort of connection. Otherwise, I'm just writing a work report, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not going to start with Luke wants to destroy the Death Star. You're going to start with, Luke wants, I don't know. I don't actually know what Luke wanted besides to destroy this. A family to find where he belongs, I guess. Luke wants to find where he right. belongs. That's probably what that one would be. And you can see they didn't start with that. You can see they started with the Death Star. But it wouldn't work if you didn't have the other thing.
Yes, that's true. And there's also something that really resonated with me. It was on that one of the very first podcasts of history, This American Life. You're probably familiar with it, with Ira Glass. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he did... I don't remember the specific episode, but it started where he talked about something called the Wish Song that appears in every Disney animated musical. The main character looks out at the landscape, whether it's in the little French town for Beauty and the Beast or in the Wishing Well for Snow White or whatever, and they sing a song, and the song expresses their wish. And so... I don't give my character a wish song, but I look for that deeply held emotional and sentimental desire, you know, the yearning that the character mm-hmm. expresses. And the story, when you build the story around the character, then her emotional journey is really the plot. She has to do something. She has to be in a world, in a situation, but her emotional journey is... really where I go to get my deepest pieces of the story.
And then when you're trying to take that emotional journey and marry it to a physical journey, do you generally know where you're going from the beginning? Is it hard to figure out what physical journey will best tell that emotional story? I'm sure you're really good at it by now.
Well, I don't know, but I do know that it's the fun part for me because I love to explore different settings. There are some writers who go back to the same setting again and again, and it really works for them, and they get known for being a writer of a certain region or something like that. For me, I love to travel. I'm such a fan of world travel, so. I love to find what milieu will bring out the deepest aspects of this character. Is it a city? Is it a beach? Is it a lake? Is it somewhere out in the countryside? Is it, you know, what time period is it? And so I have all these different explorations that I do where I find the perfect pairing. One is because some of my stories, like the Oysterville Sewing Circle, it could take place anywhere in the world. It's a group, it's a woman on a career path who has a big, complicated life situation, and she ends up forming a group for domestic violence survivors. But I ended up setting it in the most remote town, in the most remote piece of beach on the Washington coast called Oysterville, because I felt like that was a metaphor for, you know, this woman going out on a limb, you know. And on the other hand, the Lost and Found Bookshop, I wanted a bookshop on like the cutest vintage street in San Francisco. And I just want, you know, I wanted it. So usually my setting is a place that I would love to be, a place I would love to visit. Some of my favorite books are books that make me want to go there, want to be there. So I've got a stack on my desk right now. I've got on Ocean Boulevard, and there's a beach picture, and I've got Hello Summer, and there's another beach. Ooh, we got a theme going here. But So I
have Beach Read, and I was stunned to discover it's actually a lake house, but I'm sticking with it.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So the setting is something that I hope will play up aspects of the story and character in a metaphorical way. And so that's one of the things. And then the other thing that I love playing with is, as a writer, we get to live so many different lives. We get to have so many different jobs. And so every main character I've ever written has a job that I fantasize about. She's a photographer. She's a dancer. She's a writer. Well, I don't fantasize about that. I know the grim reality of that, but, I've always wanted to be a bookseller. And so the Lost and Found Bookshop was, gratifying for me to write about that. So
I bet.
But we're very lucky because we get to experience these things vicariously through our research and through the people that we write about. So it keeps it very exciting and fresh. We don't go back to the same job day in and day out.
Right. And a bookseller is an interesting observer of humanity in terms of who comes in to look at what.
And yeah.
That's a really durable archetype in fiction, which is amazing.
Hey, listeners, KJ here. Before Susan tells you what she's been reading, and let me tell you, that's a lot, let's talk about what you're writing, or rather, where you're writing. Serena and I have been loving our new Dabble Writer software. I've already raved about how intuitive it is and how much we love the plotting tool. But since this episode is about beach reads, and I hope you're finding a way to indulge in a summer getaway, I want to tell you that another cool feature of Dabble is that you can use it anywhere and on any device. Online, offline, PC, Mac, Chromebook, mobile, they all work and they're always synced up. So the edits you jotted into your phone yesterday are right there on your desktop today. We really think you'll like it, and we'd love to hear what you think. So check it out with a free trial at dabblewriter.com and then get in touch.
But I wanted to take you back a second to the Disney Wish song, because that was really interesting to me. I'm actually not a big Disney watcher, as my kids are a little older now, but I hadn't really realized that before. And I love that you start from the character's wish. I find when I start, and I'm wondering how you get past this, but sometimes... does that wish feel a little bit thin to you until you really dig in? It's like the chicken and an egg problem of character
conflict.
Absolutely.
And I'm always so envious when I open a book and the character has this life or death problem or situation, because my books are really personal and they're kind of intimate, and they're very much about a woman's desires in her everyday life. And she's not out saving the world or, vanquishing bad guys or something like that. And so my stories, until I really dig into them, feel a little everyday, a little mundane. And so I'm very sensitive about that. And it makes me work harder, all the harder, on the aspects that are really going to bring the story to life for the reader and really going to get the reader involved and behind the character. And with the Lost and Found Bookshop, one of the things that the publisher did is they sent out a lot of advanced reading copies to working booksellers, or actually furloughed booksellers because of the time that we're in. And the feedback that they got was so extraordinary that they ended up making a deck of quote cards with feedback from these booksellers. And it was really extraordinary to see how they experienced this book and what their feedback was. And so even though it was a woman who's doesn't consider herself anything special, she was really special to these readers. And so I'm really hopeful that when the book goes out into the world and is not my baby anymore, the readers will relate to that.
That's wonderful. And as you point out, those of us who write emotional journeys, you know, some days doesn't it seem super tempting to just kidnap your heroine on the first page?
Yeah, it does, really. And, you know, have her swept away by pirates or something, just to get
exactly.
the action going, when instead she's got to give a presentation at work and it sucks, and, you know, something like that. And so that's interesting that you brought that up, because my original opening scene of the Lost and Found Bookshop was pretty much exactly that. She had a work situation at her corporate job, and it does not go well. And it's very important to her, but I was concerned that the readers might not hook right into her because she's a little challenged by the situation and she's not a warm, fuzzy person in that moment. And that's a little risky to do because you want your reader to like your protagonist right from the start, right? And so I was apprehensive about doing that. And so what I did was I added, and this is something I sometimes do, I sometimes don't, I added a prologue. And the prologue put her in the most emotionally stressful situation I could find for her at that moment. And so there's like just a one page prologue. It's really quick, but it's like everything that, you know, I wanted the reader to know about this character so that when they turn the page and there she is in her work meeting and she's sweating and nervous and that sort of thing, they can relate to her in a different way. So that was actually a writing craft move that I made. You know, a lot of writing is inspiration and it's art and it's talent, but a good other segment of it is just knowing how to manipulate your craft and steer your craft towards the best experience for the reader.
It's very powerful to realize at some point in your development as an author that you have got the spotlight in two hands and you can point it, you know, wherever you want.
It is. Well, hopefully we know what to do with that spotlight. That's generally what revisions are for, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I sometimes find myself just thinking, like, I don't know, it felt kind of like this last time and it worked last time. So I'm just hoping it's working now.
Yes, and it's hard when you're deep in the weeds of your draft, of your novel. It's really, really hard to have the perspective that ultimately the reader's going to have. And sometimes you just have to forge ahead on faith.
Well, when you are lost in those weeds, do you find yourself going back to that 5 to 10 page narrative that you mentioned at the beginning?
No, what I usually do is go like pull weeds in my garden or, you know, hike with the dogs or something and try to walk away from it for a bit. And then, I also do more research. A lot of times I'm stuck at a spot in the book and I just need to read more about the situation, you know, whether it's, more articles about elder care or more articles about the Spanish-American War, which has a very weird interesting little spotlight in the book. So I sometimes just do more research. There's a very good book. There's so many good writing books, but one of them that was quite instructive to me, oh gosh, a million years ago, it was called Writing the Blockbuster Novel by Al Zuckerman. He was, maybe still is, a big agent in New York, and he was Ken Follett's agent. And he talks about when you get blocked, the first thing you should do is go back and do more research into your setting, into your situation, into the character's job. And I don't know that that resolves it every time for me, but it's very helpful.
I love books like that. I love books that at least just tell me something to do when I'm stuck. I don't, it may be anything. Just give me something I can.
Yeah. I'm a writing book junkie. I have probably, I don't know how many linear feet, maybe 16 linear feet of books on writing. And I have my favorites, but there's always something that I can glean from most of these. And I don't always work through them cover to cover, but I love browsing through them. And that's always inspiring to me as well.
I love hearing that because I am so there. I love, stuff like, you know, Save the Cat Writes a Novel and Write Your Novel in 90 days. And
yes.
It doesn't have to be great. I don't know. I like dipping out and finding a roadmap from time to time, I think.
Yeah. It goes back to writers convinced that every other writer has the secret and they're hiding it from us.
Yeah. I do have the secrets to how other people can write their books.
You
it's
go.
Only the secrets to how I can write them that turn out to be the problem.
Yeah, we're like the cobbler whose kids have bare feet.
Exactly.
Everybody else has their shoes.
Well, this is a great time to shift into talking about what we have been reading. In every episode, we like to just chat out something that we've been enjoying lately. And so I hope you've had some time to read and have something in mind that's been keeping you entertained when you're not writing right now.
Absolutely. I'm always reading, and I've always got a couple of books going, one on the nightstand and one in the living room and, you know, one wherever I happen to be in my backpack. And right now, some of my books reflect where I am in my life. I think I mentioned that my mom has moved here. She's 90. She's a bit high maintenance right now. So I'm reading, I've got a stack here. I'm reading Aging in Place by Erin D. Murphy. Not very interesting, except when you need it. But the other one that I just love, and I've read it before, but I'm rereading Being Mortal by Atul Gawande.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And then for lighthearted reading, I have the new Mary Kay Andrews, Hello Summer, was just published. And a good friend of mine, Mary Alice Monroe, has a new book out called On Ocean Boulevard. And it's like the ultimate summer read, it looks like. I haven't started it yet, but I'm looking forward to that one. I have a book here that is a memoir because one of the things that my husband does, he does a lot of things. He's a designer, but one thing that he's been doing is he's been renovating old houses, and he's not really a flipper because he renovates them beautifully and then sells them or rents them. But anyway, I'm very preoccupied with old houses these days. So I found this book, House Lessons, by Erica Bauermeister, who's written some of my favorite books. She wrote a book called The School of Essential Ingredients that I loved. And this is a memoir of restoring an old house called House Lessons, Renovating a Life. And
I love memoirs of restoring old houses, especially if she went to the country to do it. Did she go to the country to do it? Because if she hadn't,
she did. Totally she sold. Did. She went to Port Townsend, Washington, which is where The Egg and I took place, the famous memoir by Betty McDonald.
I adore The Egg and I so much so that the last time I was in Port Washington, the only time I've ever been, I made someone, you know, take me a picture with the sign. And that's one of my go-to rereads.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, that's where Erica did her house renovation and wrote House Lessons. And then for my birthday, my husband got me Untamed by Glennon Doyle. Amazing, amazing memoir about a woman's very extraordinary journey. And
yep, I'm in the middle of that one right now myself.
Oh, cool. She's a wonderful writer. And then I bought, because Father's Day is coming up and Jerry is not my father, but his sons are probably going to forget. So I bought him the new Eric Larson, The Splendid and the Vile, which is a history of Churchill during World War II. And I just love Eric's books, and Eric's a good friend of mine. And so I tease him. I say that he's everybody's father's favorite writer. You could always count on somebody's dad liking an Eric Larson book, just like you can always count on somebody's mom liking a Susan Wiggs book. So I got that one. And then
I'm somebody's mom. That must be why I like them.
There you go. And then two more in my stack. I'm looking at my nightstand. God, I need a new nightstand. This one is a collection of stories called Sabrina and Karina. There's a lot of controversy about a big book that was out earlier this year called American Dirt. And it focused some attention on Latina writers or Latinx writers. And so I decided that I did not have enough on my shelf. And so a bookseller, God love booksellers, recommended Sabrina and Karina by Kali Fajardo Onstein. I don't even know if I'm saying it right. But it won the National Book Award, and the stories are just lovely. I love them. And then finally, I just started this morning over coffee, The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo by Taylor Jenkins Reid. And if you haven't heard of her, you will soon, because her book, which was called Daisy Jones and the Six, is about to be a very big series on, I think, Amazon Prime or maybe Netflix. And quite the big hit. And I adored that book as well. So I know I'm going to like this new one. And you wonder, with all these books that I'm reading, do I have time to write? No, I don't. Do I have a deadline? Yes, I do.
No, we fully understand.
But you know what? Reading books keeps the craft alive. As a writer, you read a book differently than just a reader. And I say just a reader with a lot of respect, but it's kind of like my husband's an apparel designer, and he can look at any garment and see what it took to make that garment. And, you know, he knows a lot of technical things about it that just, you know, the casual person wouldn't even know. And I think the same can be said of writing. And it is a little harder for me, and probably you guys too, to really get into a book, just because we're also noticing things that are not supposed to be noticeable.
Mm-hmm. Every so often I'll be like, oh, I'll bet that was a major subplot at some point.
And right.
No, yes. It's not.
Yeah, I know. It's like,
no, there's a reason that dog is a German Shepherd or whatever, you know, but now there's not. And yeah, but you can go in and out of that mode, right?
That's correct. Yeah. And, you know, my favorite books are the ones that make me forget I'm a writer and I'm just swept away by the story. So that's always the goal.
Well, so I think rather than say anything that I'm reading, just because we have a great list here, I'm going to just ask you one last question, which is, sure. Do you read fiction while you're writing it?
Always. Yes, I do.
We love that. We do too. But so many people don't.
Or
say they don't.
I would probably go through withdrawal symptoms if I couldn't read fiction. And so for some reason, it's not a problem for me personally to distinguish what I'm writing from what I'm reading. And, you know, that I don't know if that's true for everybody, but it doesn't seem to be a problem for me. Maybe it's telling that one of my first things that I remember writing for publication was when I was in seventh grade. They decided to publish a book report that I had written in the newspaper because I was supposed to do a book report on Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. And I was so destroyed by the ending of that book that I rewrote the whole ending of the book. And that was my book report.
I love it.
And so my seventh grade teacher thought that it was interesting enough that, you know, she published it in the newspaper. So that was one of my first publishing credits. I was rewriting John Steinbeck. So I don't know, maybe you need that level of arrogance to kind of push your way into publishing.
I think that you predicted your own future. Well, Susan, we have to respect your time, but we are so grateful that you came and did this. I think this was a fantastic conversation about writing. I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love talking shop with you guys. You're amazing.
It's great. So for our listeners, you're definitely going to want to look for the Lost and Found Bookshop. And also, you know, maybe take a look at the Oysterville Sewing Circle and if you just want to look at SusanWiggs.com, you're sure to find something that you will dig. Or hey, if you, you know, would rather take it that way, that your mother will dig, right? this mother does. So, I don't know, Serena, you want to take us out with our always final saying?
I will. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
This episode of Hashtag Am Writing with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work.
Save, pause, stop, stall.